subordinate to man. I mean, that's an interesting beginning, isn't it?
It most certainly is. There are two, as you say, there are two stories in this one account, two sides of this account. The first time, God creates humanity, male and female, simultaneously, according to the story, instantaneously. In the second account, which follows just a few verses later, God does it again, but this time God creates the male first, and from the rib of Adam, he creates the woman. And so the patriarchs of the church, the doctors of the church throughout the centuries have interpreted this as meaning that the woman is inferior. I mean, that's such a fallacious and unscholarly approach to it as to be absurd, but it nonetheless has caused not only a lot of mischief, but a lot of pain and persecution, and has been largely responsible in many parts of our culture for the inferior and abused status of women. It's reinforced, by the way, in the New Testament by some of Paul's teachings about women, the role of women in the church, not being able to be deacons or ordained as ministers, and wives, be submissive to your husbands, all of that sort of thing has been reused. A lot of religion gives God a bad name. There's no question about it. The Bible is full of violence that is sanctioned for those who are chosen against those who are not chosen, according to how you see it. So, you know, all the religions of the world are like great rivers that keep running from the past, and sometimes they bring flotsam and jetsam to us. Sometimes they bring bad things down, floating downstream with us. Sometimes they bring good things. And the real task, it seems to me, in life as it is in religion, is to choose which side of our nature we're going to nurture. And fortunately, I think more and more people are beginning to dissect the negative sides of religion and try to remove them and get rid of this misogyny, get rid of this patriarchal emphasis that's been drawn on it. But in Genesis, these two accounts are not incompatible to me. I mean, they're simply telling a story and by the way, we don't know who wrote them. We don't know what time they were written. Both stories were probably written a long time apart. And the redactors or the editors of Genesis, the people who put it together to try to explain the origins of the Jewish people, put those two stories together for some reason lost to us. But when you take them literally, you get into considerable deep water with them.
Also in Genesis, it comes through very dramatically the attribution of human qualities to God. God is vengeful, he's vindictive, he's compassionate. He does all the things human beings do. And what about that?
Well, it does reinforce the notion that perhaps a lot of this is our creating God in our image. I mean, clearly the story of Genesis, there were two great books last year, I think, that addressed this issue. One was Karen Armstrong's book, A History of God, 52 more weeks on the bestseller list, and Jack Miles' book, God, A Biography, which won the Pulitzer Prize as the best book of 1995. And both of them point out that as you read Genesis closely and consecutively, you get different images of God that appear, different uses different expressions of God, so that it's our imperfection and our flaws that perceive God only in bits and pieces as we go along, that keeps drawing out different aspects of God. I mean, there in the first book of Genesis, God creates the earth and pronounces it good, comes down and walks in the garden with his own creatures. Seven times God says this is good, but six chapters later and 10 generations later, God is so angry at the world that God is destroying humanity, wiping out with a mighty flood. This is two different gods, God who loves his creation and God who walks gently in the garden with his creatures, and the God who is so angry, who's so violently predisposed to wipe this out that he destroys innocent children in the process. I mean, these are two different pictures of God. Jack Miles says in that book about the flood of Noah, this is not the story of a good God saving a good man from a natural calamity. This is the story of a good God saving a good man from a bad God. And the horror of the story is that the good God and the bad God are one and the same. What does this do to your faith? What does this do to the notion, the nature of God as we perceive it?
And then I think after the flood, doesn't God promise Noah that he'll never do this again to the creatures of the earth?
He sends a rainbow as a sign of his covenant. And yet, no sooner has Noah come down off of the ark and built an altar than Noah gets drunk, falls into a drunken stupor, and when he gets up from that stupor, is so incensed at his children that he abuses his grandson. So God saves this, quote, righteous man, we're told in the Bible, to give humanity a second chance, and no sooner has the second chance begun than the hero of the story descends to alcoholism and sexual perversion. I mean, what's going on here? It must have broken God's heart.
Yeah, yeah. And that also runs through the Genesis, the abuse of children. I mean, that happens with Abraham and, I mean, the Isaac story. I mean, there couldn't be anything more abusive than that.
You know, I grew up thinking that that story was an effort to show how God tested the faith of Abraham. No mention was made in the culture where I grew up of what that impact might have been on Isaac. Here was this boy bound by his father, thrown on the rock, and his father raises the knife ahead of him, above him, and is about to plunge it when suddenly he stops. Now, that's how the story was presented to us. Listening to the Jews in our sessions was quite instructive to me, because they don't call it, of course, the sacrifice of Isaac. They call it the binding of Isaac, because Isaac wasn't sacrificed. And as one of the Jewish participants says, this may well have been the effort of our deep ancestors to say that child sacrifice, which was practiced in the world widely at that time, in the known world at that time, is not favorable in God's sight. That God was, this story is used to put an end to child sacrifice. Interesting twist on this story. But yes, you're right that so much of these stories are not only misogynist, but they are difficult to explain and accept in other ways, too. And they require thought. That's why this discussion about them is so interesting. If you just read these stories on your own without the help of any other opinions and interpretations, you can really take away some weird conclusions from them. But it's in the discussion of other people who've spent a lot of time studying them that the text really becomes alive, and you can begin to experience something through the text that you can't if you just read it alone. That's why we're encouraging people all over the country to join in dialogue, watch these programs, gather your friends and people who are not like you, not from the same neighborhood around, watch them, talk about them, get different interpretations of them, and let the discussion really bring forth a candid but collegial and civil debate and dialogue about what these stories might mean in our world.
One of the things that you've done is you've created a resource guide called Talking About Genesis. I have to say, it's quite good. I mean, it's a very excellent guide to forming the groups you're talking about and how to work with that.
Well, this is so important because, you know, America, every morning when I wake up in America, it's more unlike it was yesterday. We are home to the world's religions now. When I went to New York in 1968, I was surprised to see people on the subway reading the Hebrew Bible. I didn't see that in East Texas. I was surprised to see people reading the Bible in Spanish. I didn't see that in East Texas. Now I'm just as likely to see someone reading the Koran as I am to see them reading the Bible. There are 5 to 6 million Muslims in this country, more Muslims than Episcopalians or Presbyterians.
Wow.
And very likely to be more Muslims in America in the next 7 years than Jews. Our religious reality is changing. 1 million Hindus in this country, 1 million Buddhists in this country, by some rough estimate. So we're really changing. We have to learn how to talk to people who are unlike us, and listen to that. I said to Houston Smith on our interview, how do I hold my truth to be the truth when everyone else sees the truth differently? He paused a moment and he said, we listen. We listen as intently to the other person's experience of reality, explanation of reality, as we hope they listen to us. Now, from that, we don't buy into their view of reality, perhaps. We don't say, okay, I agree with you, or I will accept your view. We come away, though, knowing where he or she comes from. And this helps us in our protocol of relationships with them. And we have to do this in America. You quoted me in the beginning saying that we're searching for a new vision in America that is inclusive. Well, all parties have to be part of that dialogue if we're going to create a livable civilization.
Now, through your work, Bill, you have done a lot of coverage of politics and social change and what's going on in the social fabric of America. And I notice, particularly with Genesis and with The Wisdom of Faith, with Houston Smith, certainly the Campbell series, you're kind of moving into an area of spirituality, of work with the soul, of a deeper values. And I wanted to ask you about, how do you see this bridging? I mean, it seems to me like one of the things that's missing in political discussions is any recognition of the spiritual, of the soul life. It's not included. How do you see that?
Well, one of the reasons that I've done these stories, and while I've done these stories, by the way, done these series with Joseph Campbell and Houston Smith and Genesis, I've also been doing more traditional journalism. I just aired recently a two-hour look at the inequities in funding of public education in this country, and I've done documentaries on political and other economic subjects. I did a documentary recently about the impact of downsizing on middle-class families. But one of the reasons I've come to the subject of religion is because religion means so much to so many people. 9 out of 10 Americans say they never doubt the existence of God. Half the country goes to church, synagogue, or mosque every week, or at least once a month. So religion is important to people, and because it's important, it needs to be taken seriously by mainstream media. A second reason is I'm just weary of having the right wing drive the discussion of religion, the political and religious discourse of this country, ever since the Moral Majority. And I just want to show that there are other people out there who are talking about religion who are not politicizing it, not polemicizing it, and not polarizing the community by talking about it. But the main reason, and then there's a third reason, which is I'm interested in this subject. This is a neglected subject of journalism. There's plenty of talk on television about economics, about government, about politics, about sports, wrestling, sex, auto racing, foreign affairs, all kinds of affairs.
Beach volleyball.
But there's no discussion, there's no religious discussion. There's lots of talk about religion, but not religious discussion. When you and I were growing up, the networks had a religious ghetto on Sunday morning in which they produced some very fine religious programming. Now that ghetto's been claimed by the politicians. It's a political ghetto now. Politics has become the corner of the realm, and yet millions of Americans take the religious search seriously. We journalists need to take it seriously, too.
Well, it's also in some ways been claimed by certain sects of the religious field, because now, you know, like 15 years ago, that programming was provided free as public service or public affairs, the FCC, deregulation and all of that, then suddenly that time became valuable. And so now it's who pays for the time.
So Jerry Falwell can buy an hour every Sunday on television stations all across the country,
right,
trying to sell you something, trying to sell you his version of religion.
Right.
No, you're right. Exactly. So that's one reason why, as a journalist, I just said I want to treat some of these subjects in mainstream TV.
Why do you think it is that with all the, I mean, when you think of how many television stations, there are 10,000 radio stations. I think there are a couple thousand television stations. There's all this media. We're talking about 500 channels coming down the pike. You can go into many major metropolitan area and you've got 60 or 70 channels to draw from. And rarely can you ever find anything like Genesis or Bill Moyer's Journal. I mean, it's like kind of you're a light in the midst of all this darkness. And I'm wondering, asking you the question, why is that? I mean, there's a blindness here. There's a missing link. What do you see?
Well, commercial television is driven by the lowest common denominator. And we're talking here about matters of the spirit, matters of the soul, matters of faith. And that's not the lowest common denominator. Second, we've come steadily in this country toward a view of the human being as merely the sum of his physical appetites, and of America as nothing but an economic machine. So anything outside the realm of raw appetite or economics isn't considered germane to the agenda of most people who buy into this worldview of the human being as the sum of his or her physical appetites, or as America as an economic machine. There's a third reason. This is a difficult subject to deal with, frankly. I mean, television cameras don't capture, quote, religion very clearly. I mean, what truly happens in the realm of the spirit lies beyond the camera. And so it's very difficult for journalists to treat it who are accustomed to the visual coverage of news. Finally, because there are so many different interpretations of God. You mentioned the God in the company of three people, and you get three different opinions. It's a very difficult subject to compose the way television composes its programming. So for those reasons, as well as the fact that a lot of people are uncomfortable with it, my friend and colleague William F. Buckley has been known to say that if you mention the subject of God at a New York dinner party, the first reference brings silence, but the second reference means you never get invited back. So religion has been marginalized. I think it's okay to talk about God as long as we're not trying to proselytize or trying to coerce or trying to flim-flam anyone.
I'm speaking with Bill Moyers, creator of Genesis, A Living Conversation. My name is Michael Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. What about the possibility that this extraordinary dialogue that you've created, do you think it has there's so many different people involved here that there's a possibility that the old-time doctrine and dogma might be undermined, and maybe that's good. I don't know. What about that?
Well, I think the Bible is a closed book unless you approach it with an open heart. And if you are alarmed or disarmed by what others say about your faith instead of learning from them, instead of taking it and thinking about it, then you're probably not on very strong ground in the first place in terms of your doctrine or your theology. Doctrine and theology are a lot less important to me than the experience that comes from actually thinking about, talking about, and trying to live your beliefs. You know, I am a Christian. I was raised in a Christian church. I still find in the story of Christianity, my own story, and something about the revelation of God as I perceive it, perceive God. But I've learned so much over the years from listening to other religions. From Buddhism, I've learned the importance of serenity and contemplation and the mindfulness of the present moment. You know, I was raised to think only of the eternity, the life after, but I missed a lot of life because of that. So Buddhists have taught me about the importance of the present experience. From the Confucianist, I've learned a lot about the importance of composing the social, of the importance of harmony within before you can have harmony in society. I mean, the teachings of Confucius, who was clearly no god, kept the 900 million people of the planet together as a coherent society for a long time. And their emphasis upon the ethical relationship between us in a society has meant a great deal to me. From Judaism, I've gotten this magnificent emphasis upon the prophetic voice, the importance of conscience, the fact that speaking truth to power grows out of a deep idea of who your God is. That's been very important to me. Even in my own shortcomings, it's been a great importance to me. From the Sufi Muslims, this incredible notion of the union of between God, of God as your lover, this yearning for this intimacy with God is something that means a great deal to me. From the Buddhist also, from the Taoist, this notion of yin and yang, of how melded and mixed our human natures are with the black dot in the white matrix and the white dot in the black matrix. I was taught that life is good or bad, that people are good and evil. And in fact, we all contain good and bad. We all contain good and evil. And from the Taoist, I've taken this. So the point I'm making is that no matter what, how firm you are in your own foundation, you can listen to other people talk about their experience of reality and get something from it that grows your own understanding of your own religion. And as Houston Smith said in that series of interviews I did with them, you don't have to abandon your own religious tradition in order to hear other people. You just have to go deeper into it, because underneath all of these, particularly these six enduring traditions, is a common water table of humanity. Belief may flower, as I've said earlier, in a thousand blooms, but underneath it is a common aspiration to experience a transcendent reality and to find meaning in life. So listening to others and having them listen to you is a way to grow your own faith, I think.
How has doing Genesis changed your life?
Well, I take something from every experience, and from this I was just so intrigued rediscover these characters and these stories of Genesis as human beings like me. When I was growing up, they were 10 feet tall. They were the Bible heroes, the patriarchs of the faith. They were Abraham was in stained glass windows, you know, in Christian churches everywhere. Moses, people like that. But when you go back and see these people, they're men and women, flawed and weak and tempted and violent and wrestling all the way. I mean, that whole image of Jacob wrestling at night with either the idea of his brother, who at that moment was coming to meet him after their long separation, and perhaps even to kill him. Wrestling with God, wrestling with angels. I wrestle with my own fantasies at night, my own fate. I wrestle with my own brother. He died at 39 with a lot unresolved between us. I mean, when Jacob is wrestling, he comes away renewed but scarred, limping for the rest of his life. And I find that so fitting in my own life that my personal transformations, which have brought occasional renewal, have never been without a price. I find these stories so starkly real because they really are about people like me.
So going to Buddhism and then what the Buddha said, one of the truths is that life is suffering. There is suffering that we need to endure. It's through suffering, perhaps, that we grow.
It's one of the realities that to deny leaves you demented and tormented by your inability to explain, why me?
Yeah.
It's not just why me. It's everybody.
And there may not be an answer to that question that we can understand with our human capacity.
That's the thing about the stories in Genesis, Michael, is they don't have happy endings. They're not American stories. They're not themes of Disneyland and Disney World. These are stories about people who live with ambiguity. They're never sure what to make of God. And as I read the stories of Genesis, God is never sure what to make of them. And that's true in our own lives as well. These stories do not give us moral guidance. They simply reflect back to us the mirror of a common humanity in which all of us at one moment may have the capacity to hear the voice of God and at the next moment may be striking at our brother.
Yeah. Do you think we all do hear the voice of God in some way?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. If I had a tape recorder inside my mind, I don't think I would ever have been able to capture the spoken word of God. I don't. Fanatics say they do, although a fanatic has been rightly defined as somebody who is doing what he knows God would do if God had the facts like he does.
Right.
Schizophrenics hear the voice of God. Martin Luther King apparently heard the call of God and led his people to the mountaintop. Jim Jones and David Koresh heard the call of God, they said, and led their people to an inferno. How do we distinguish between the authentic and the mentally ill call, the voice of God? I think, as my friend Martin Marty, the professor of history at University of Chicago, Christian history, or religious history, says, the real test comes in watching over a long period of time anybody who claims to be acting from an inner call, from the call of God, watching that person act in community, having his or her ideas tested in time. And Martin Marty says, far better to trust the half-certain than to trust the cocksure. And I think true religion breeds humility, not pride. There's a wonderful line in one of Kathleen Norris's poems where she says, we are now chosen, all of us. And then she pauses and in the next line says, God help us because of it. It's that kind of humility that I think comes out of the authentic experience of a call or a voice. Emerson said that the ultimate test of religion is its civilizing power. And I think it's hard for me to believe that I could hear the voice of God and act indifferently or coldly or cruelly or harshly to any one of God's other creatures. And I think somewhere in there, there's a measure of the call.
Bill, thanks for joining us today. I've been speaking with Bill Moyers, television journalist and creator of Genesis, A Living Conversation on PBS Television, and the book Genesis, A Living Conversation, published by Doubleday. My name is Michael Toms. On behalf of the New Dimensions radio staff and all those who are members of Friends of New Dimensions, I'm wishing you well. This is program number 2592.
You've been listening to a New Dimensions archive edition, recorded in 1996. New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA.
Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over four decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org. Or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Disasters like wildfires and hurricanes can destroy electrical lines, leading to long blackouts. When the power's out, it's only a matter of time before the food in the fridge and freezer starts to go bad. So if you think you might lose electricity, stock up on foods that do not need to be refrigerated, like crackers, peanut butter, cereal, and apples. Move refrigerated foods into the freezer so they'll stay cold for a longer time without power. You can also store food in a cooler filled with ice. If you need to cook, you can use an outdoor grill when the weather is safe. Or if you have a gas stove, you may be able to manually light it with matches. During a blackout, keep the fridge and freezer doors closed as much as possible so the food stays cold. But if the power stays out for 4 hours or more, toss anything in the fridge that can go bad, like meat, milk, leftovers, or eggs. Do the same if a refrigerator thermometer shows that the temperature in the fridge has risen above 40 degrees. And if you're not sure if something is still safe to eat, throw it out. As climate change causes more extreme weather, power outages may become more likely. But preparing ahead of time can help get you through a blackout safely. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.